I'd like to inform everyone that call is now being recorded. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Okay, thank you. Well, welcome everyone to September 2007 Charm Telecon. And I'm Amanda Hendricks, and I'll be hosting the telecon today, the presentation. And I'd like to introduce our speaker, who's Dr. Assam Maarouf. And he is a professor at the San Jose State University here in California, and is a member of the Cassini Radio Science Subsystem Team, or the RSS team. And today he's going to be telling us about radio science, the way that they do things, and some of the results that they've been getting. With that, I will let you take over.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Okay. First, I'd like to encourage you to interrupt and ask questions whenever you think there is something that's a point you'd like to make or an issue that's not clear. Free to interrupt and ask questions. I also would like to say that the presentation today is just a small facet of what radio science actually does. It is a selected set of subjects based on some of the experiments we completed the last 2 years, but the experiments include many other things which I'll try to say in passing, but I have not tried to make a whole complete kind of presentation. I presume in the future there will be other presentations that would also cover the subjects I'll leave out. So the presentation today will cover some of what we do at Titan and some of what we do at Saturn. I'll mention in passing, as I said, the other things we do both at Titan and Saturn and other satellites. So the experiments are conducting by a team. So if you go to slide number 2, you will see a listing of the team. There are 11 members of the NASA selected team, and then there are 2 associate members also, and they come from a broad range of institutions. 3 of them are from Italy, and the rest are from the United States. So the work I'm presenting is a collective work, and I'm just the one that has the chance to tell you about what we do today. But I would also like to mention that the Cassini Radio Science team is complemented by a Cassini Radio Science Engineering team that actually implements these experiments, and their contributions are just as valuable as the contributions that the scientists make. So I'd like to recognize their efforts today, because they have been instrumental in making many of these experiments work. Slide 3 introduces you to the system we use to do the experiments I discussed today. The radio science experiments are conducted in more than one configuration. This is one of them, called the downlink configuration, and that is a configuration in which the spacecraft transmits radio signals to the Earth receiving stations, the Deep Space Network Earth receiving stations. So the instrument is really 2 pieces. One is on board the spacecraft, and one is on the ground. And the spacecraft itself generates a sinusoidal signal, which is the basis for all the experiments, generated from an ultra-stable oscillator. It's a crystal oscillator that's kept in an oven on board the spacecraft, so that the frequency is able as a function of time. And that's very critical for the kind of experiments we do, because all the experiments, whether they are in this configuration or other experiments, they rely on measurements of the frequency of that sinusoid, and therefore the frequency has to be extremely stable on the spacecraft. It's by using a crystal oscillator. In other experiments, we use the maser on the ground, which is an atomic frequency reference with much better stability. But for these experiments I've discussed today, the spacecraft generates 3 sinusoids. Actually, they are all derived from that ultra-stable oscillator, which has stability of about 1 part in 10 to the minus 13, orders of magnitude better than any watch or clock that you have here on the Earth for normal purposes. And it transmits these 3 sinusoids simultaneously, so we get to study the effect of the medium probes on the signals at multiple wavelengths at the same time. On the ground, the three sinusoids are usually received by two separate stations. One receives the longest wavelengths and the next shortest one, called S-band and X-band, and the table shows the wavelengths to be 13 centimeters and 3.6 centimeters. All these experiments are microwave range kind of experiments, so the wavelength is in the centimeters kind of range, and the X-band is the prime signal we use, which is the 3.6 centimeters, and the S-band and the K-band are supplementary wavelengths that add information to the one we get from the prime signal, the X-band signal. The power transmitted is very small, 10 to 20 watts kind of range. The table actually is messed up a little bit in the PDF version. I think that's just because of the compression applied, but there is a 7 under the SNR that should have been next, right on top of the 19, and 48 right on top of the 54. But the power transmitted at these three frequencies are from the 7 to 20 watts kind of range, so it's very little. But because of the use of these giant antennas on the ground, and because they are also cryogenically cooled, we get a very respectable kind of signal-to-noise ratio, which is critical for the kind of signals you will see in a second. Some of them are pretty weak signals. So the effect then on this downlink signal of the medium we probe provide us with information about the medium, but it's important to know what the system looks like so that you understand what kind of experiments we do afterwards. So if I go to the next slide, slide 4, it shows in words the types of observation lumped in two main types. One conducted in the configuration I just mentioned, called downlink configuration, or one-way configuration, because of the fact that it's just a spacecraft-to-Earth kind of a signal. And that includes some of the experiments I'll talk about today, the radio occultation of the rings. So the rings, when they interrupt the downlink, we study the rings by the effect on the downlink. Same for Saturn atmosphere or Titan atmosphere or ionosphere. And we do a third type of experiment called the bistatic experiment, which I'll actually start with in a short while. But I'd like to mention also, I'm not going to talk about Saturn occultations today, except in passing, because the Titan occultations give you the flavor of the experiment and what we do with an occultation of an atmosphere, and Saturn would be just more repetition of the same thing, but for a totally different target. The family of experiments also include what's called uplink, downlink, or two-way observations. So the radio signals are actually transmitted from the ground to the spacecraft, and then that's the uplink, and then the spacecraft returns the signal back to the ground coherently, that is to say, preserving the phase of the sinusoid we transmit. And that's because in measuring very small frequencies, when a spacecraft goes by a body like Saturn or a satellite like Titan or like Enceladus or like any of the relatively large satellites of Saturn, the frequency, or the gravitational field of the satellite perturbs the frequency, but the perturbations are very, very small, so you need a much more stable frequency reference, and therefore a maser on the ground is used, an atomic reference on the ground is used instead of the crystal oscillator on board the spacecraft, and this way the reference frequency comes from the ground and not from the spacecraft, and the Doppler measured is measured to a lot more accuracy. So this family of experiments, gravity field observations of Saturn, Titan, and the major satellites, is a whole major area in itself and deserves a whole talk by itself in the future, but it's not a subject I'll touch upon today because of the time limitations. So next slide shows the configuration now with the with the medium being included. Also, the medium here is just chosen to be the Titan atmosphere, so I'll start by talking about Titan occultations and Titan bistatic observations. And as you can see here, the link, the down link I just described a second ago, is now being interrupted by the atmosphere of Titan, and therefore the effect on the radio signals are observed at the DSN, at the Deep Space Network stations, and then analyzed for information about the atmosphere of Titan itself. Or on the right, you'll see a cartoon where it says from spacecraft to DSN. This is the spacecraft pointing to Titan and illuminating the surface by the radio signals, which are then reflected from the surface to the Deep Space Network to tell us something about the surface of Titan. But the geometry here is such that the normal to Titan, the thin black line you see emanating from the surface of Titan, divides the angle equally between the direction from the spacecraft and the direction to the Deep Space Network. So we're really looking for mirror-like reflection or quasi-specular kind of reflection from the surface. There, the radio signal is used as a probe of the surface, while in the first case, it's used as a probe of the atmosphere and the ionosphere. In both these cases, we maneuver, as a function of time, we maneuver the spacecraft in a very elaborate way so that the signal from the spacecraft reaches the Earth. So in the case of an occultation, because the radio signal bends in the atmosphere, the picture you see here is highly simplistic. It shows a line just going through the atmosphere going to Earth. But in reality, the line refracts, and the line is a wave, and the wave goes through an inhomogeneous atmosphere of Titan, so it bends. And we have to maneuver the spacecraft so that when the ray bends, the signal still goes to Earth. So we execute what's called the limb track maneuver during one of these occultations, which is a demanding kind of a design because Titan, the flybys of Titan are usually very fast, so we have to keep the spacecraft pointing in the right direction as a function of time by using the thrusters, because there you can move things very quickly, much more quickly than using the reaction wheel. And in the case of the bistatic from the surface of Titan, we have to maneuver the spacecraft constantly as a function of time to look at the region of the surface where this mirror-like reflection is expected. So both of these experiments are not static in the sense that the spacecraft has to be moved as a function of time in very specific directions. And therefore, when these experiments are conducted, we need to know the trajectory of the spacecraft very accurately. And usually the trajectory is predicted long time before the experiment. But because we're so sensitive to errors in the trajectory at the level of 1 second or sub 1 second sometimes, what happens is that the navigation team, 1 week before the experiment, gives us their best estimate of the trajectory, and then we use that estimate to do what's called a live update. We update all the pointing on the spacecraft and uplink the new sequence to the spacecraft, and then execute it based on the best knowledge we have at the time. If we don't do that, we would miss all these occultations because they happen so fast. And as you will see in a second, we did 4 of these and all worked very nicely. So without this kind of a capability, we would not be able really to do these occultations. So the next slide, I'll start with the Titan, but the surface part of it, the bistatic part of it, then I'll discuss the occultations. And then at the end, I'll take the rings of Saturn as an example from Saturn observations. So we've done so far 4 experiments that all relate to this bistatic experiment. They were on the flybys number 12, 14, and then recently, those were last year, March and May of last year. And then on March and May of this year, again, we did on March and July of this year, we did 2 more, 27 and 34. And the chart you see here shows the location on the surface of Titan where this mirror reflection happened. The technical term for that is specular reflection. So these are called the specular tracks or the ground tracks for the specular point. And what you see here is the latitude of the point on the surface of Titan where the beam penetrated the surface or illuminated the surface, and the longitude. So this is just location on the surface. And you can see your eye, the dashed red line is the equatorial. So this is zero latitude. So you can see most of them were near equatorial, at least on T12, T14, and T34. Only T27 diverted substantially from the near equatorial and illuminated on the inbound side, or the ingress side, very high south latitude kind of regions on the surface of Titan, and on the outbound or egress side, near 20 degrees latitude, 20 to 30 degrees latitude. So the examples I'll give you today, we've seen bistatic echo on most of these. Some are weak, some are strong, and only one of them we haven't seen anything, and that was the 27 outbound one, egress. And I'll describe for you today why we see echo sometimes and why not. It all depends on the nature of the surface that we illuminate. And the next slide will show just the Cassini website schematic illustration of the one of the experiments on T27. And the reason I'm showing this is just to make the point that if you look at the spacecraft on the right and Earth is on the lower left, the spacecraft is pointing directly to Earth through the atmosphere of Titan in a cartoonish kind of way. And then the spacecraft on the left illuminates the surface and the reflected signal, which are the blue bubbles you see emanating from the surface back to Earth. You can see that it takes a very large change in geometry to go from the occultation geometry to the bistatic geometry. And the spacecraft has to be maneuvered to change that trajectory to that kind of orientation in a very short time. So there is a very elaborate maneuver involved that allows doing the occultation and the bistatic on the same flyby.
And that's what you did on T27?
It's done on T27 and T14, both of them.
And back to slide 6, I wanted to ask you, you said you didn't get a signal back on the ingress. Oh, no. Oh, was it the egress of T34?
No, on the egress of T27. That's the only one we didn't get a signal from.
Because I see blue points up in the northern hemisphere.
You're talking about slide 6?
Yeah.
Yeah, the T27E is the one from 20 to 30 degrees latitude north latitude. And that's the one that did not show any echo at all.
Oh, I see. Okay, I thought this was somehow showing us your output. Okay, it's just showing where you...
Yeah, that's only where we looked at where on the surface we've looked, the spacecraft looked. So slide 7 was just a schematic illustration of the fact that you need to change orientation substantially over a very short period of time. So here is slide 8 shows the actual, just to get a feel for the complexity of these experiments, it shows the timeline that we followed for executing this T27 experiment. So on the top right, you'll see Titan as viewed from Earth, and you'll see that the spacecraft was coming from towards the south pole of Titan, and then hiding behind Titan for a while and from an observer on Earth, and then exiting close to mid-northern latitude, and then continuing. And you see the tick marks are only 5 minutes apart, so the duration of the bistatic and the occultation are short, and you'll see the exact times in the detailed diagram below. So if you take Titan and just turn it on its side so that you can sketch time running from left to right, that's the picture at the bottom. So you see again Titan, and the red line is the trajectory of the spacecraft as you would see it from the Earth. and the spacecraft is coming from the left, moving to the right, and the tick marks are again 5 minutes. And centered on Titan itself, if you look at the colored line just below Titan, you'll see a block called occultation, which lasts from 0110 to 0146, 36 minutes. During that period, we did the occultation experiment. And on the wings outside before that and after that, we did turns to do the bistatic experiment on the inbound side, on the outbound side. And before that, the green blocks show that we have directed the spacecraft to collect a baseline by pointing the spacecraft to Earth and looking at the signals before we do anything. And before that, the brown boxes show that we've done some calibrations so that we know exactly the performance of the system we're using, and therefore we actually measure the system noise temperature so that we can characterize the strength of the echo in an accurate way. So coming from the left to the right, the sequence of events are as follows. We calibrate the system for some time before even Cassini turns to Earth. Then when Cassini turns to Earth, we collect a baseline. Then we turn to Titan and do a bistatic experiment. Then we turn from Titan to Earth and do an occultation, and then do the opposite going out. And the observations during that period are observed by the DSN at the stations that are indicated with the bottom two lines. Both the Madrid complex and the Goldstone complex were observing during that day with two stations each. As I said, the X and S band are received usually by the large 70-meter station. So this is DSS 63 in Madrid and DSS 14 in Goldstone here in California. And then the K band and a backup X band are observed by the smaller antennas, the 34-meter antennas, which are DSS 55 in Madrid and 25 and 26 in Goldstone. So there were five stations observing that night. Each one observes two frequencies, so that's 10 channels, and then each one recording also two polarizations at each frequency, 20 receiving channels. I'm not really aware of any radio science experiment ever conducted that approaches this kind of complexity, where there are 20 receiving channels being recorded at the same time. All that's done in real time. The DSN operators are in touch with the engineering team in the operations room, and everything has to be executed to perfection, really, to collect the data during the period of time. And that's why I say the engineering team did a wonderful job, because this is not easy to do. Usually occultations happen at one frequency with one station with one polarization, or two polarizations and two frequencies, but never really with this kind of complexity. Cassini is the most radio science capable kind of spacecraft, utilizing two wavelengths. And of course, when we do bistatic observations, we have to record two polarizations, like I'll describe in a second. And therefore, this is the most complex kind of experiment you can think of. And the other people to thank here, or to mention in thankfulness also, are the DSN people, because we have, somehow they have to, since they are part of the instrument that night, they just don't do the usual job of just recording a downlink. They actually have to participate in the experiment and have the instrument in a configuration that is proper for the experiment, and they have come throughout all the experiments we've done so far, and do deserve to be thanked for their efforts. So I will just give you a feel for what kind of geometric conditions apply for an experiment like that by going to slide 9. And there are four panels that I'll run through very quickly clockwise. So I'll start from the top left. And so all these are, the horizontal axis is the time of the experiment relative to closest approach. So the bistatic for, this is P14, started at about minus 50 minutes before closest approach. That's the vertical dashed line, and ended at about minus 20 minutes where we have to turn to start the occultation. We have to turn to start the occultation. So the experiment typically lasts 30 minutes. It's usually of that order for all of them. This is just a typical example. And the angle on the vertical axis is an angle I yet to define, so let's leave that to the next slide. But the thing that you see here, that it's in a range called the Brewster angle range, and I'll describe in a second what that means exactly and why that's important. But T14, as you can see here, is well within the Brewster angle range. Next one on the right is the distance of the spacecraft from the specular point on Titan, and as you can see, as a function of time, the spacecraft is approaching Titan in this case. It changes quickly from about 15,000 kilometers, typically 20 to 15,000 kilometers. And when we're close to Titan, typically it's a few thousand kilometers, 5,000 kilometers, or 6 to 7,000 in this particular case, kilometers from Titan. So we do the experiment relatively close to Titan, and that's because we would like, the echo is weak, and we'd like to maximize the signal-to-noise ratio, so we cannot do it while the spacecraft is very far away from Titan. Next, bottom right, is the expected bandwidth of the echo, which is typically in the range of few kilohertz. And finally, the one on the left bottom is a very important one. It shows that as a function of time, the expected frequency of the center of the echo changes very quickly as a function of time, starting from about 160 kilohertz and ending at about 120 kilohertz. That means if we don't do anything, if we just listen to the echo, waiting for it with a receiver that has a fixed kind of a frequency, it will drift very quickly out of the band and we wouldn't be able to see it. So the only way to see the echo is to tune the receiver so that it follows in Doppler. It follows in frequency that changes due to the Doppler shift of the echo, expected Doppler shift of the echo. So it's like trying to track a moving train. If you just stand at the station and watch the train go by, it drafts by you and you don't see the echo except for a very short piece of time. So the only way to track the train is you have to ride a train that's moving on a parallel track, so to speak, and therefore you're watching it all the time if you're going with the same speed. So what we do is we tune the receivers based on a priori estimates of what's expected to happen. So we have to construct a model for what the experiment looks like. So we know the trajectory, we know where Titan is, we know where the specular point is, we predict the Doppler shift, including the effect of the atmosphere on the signal, and then tune the receivers the night of the experiment based on these predictions. And if we've done a good job, then the echo should be stationary in the center of the band during the time of the experiment, if it's present. So the next slide then, slide 10, quickly shows the basic principle behind a bistatic observation, and I will take just a minute to explain what's going on here because it's critical for understanding the results. So the top right picture shows the spacecraft looking, illuminating a surface, and the surface has a mean surface, which is the dashed line, the dashed horizontal line. That's just the mean surface of Titan in this case. The actual surface may be rough and will undulate randomly around that dashed line. So that's the solid line called true surface in the diagram. If the surface was exactly flat, then the signal would bounce from the surface, much like mirror reflection happens, where the angle of incidence called phi zero in the diagram, which is the angle between the ray connecting the spacecraft to Titan and the normal to the surface called phi zero, and would reflect in the specular direction as also phi zero. And we would see only one, in that case, we would see a spike in the spectrum of the signal corresponding to that one single ray coming from the spacecraft connecting the Earth through this mirror reflection. In reality, the surface is not really exactly flat, and undulates like you see in here. So individual facets of the surface that are slightly different from the mean orientation reflect the echo at slightly different angles than phi zero. And because the echo is Doppler shifted, it's received at the ground at slightly different at the frequency from the original ray I just told you about, where the surface is exactly flat. So individual randomly oriented facets reflect the echo or reflect the signal at slightly different frequencies. And what one receives on the ground then is a spectrum rather than just a single line. And the cartoon of the so-called received power versus frequency that you see in the diagram is a cartoon of a spectrum, a spread in frequency around the expected frequency. And the rougher the surface is, the more spread that spectrum is. And of course, if it's very smooth, then the spectrum becomes a very narrow kind of a spectrum, which we call quasi-specular spectrum in this case. And the area under this curve, under this spectrum, is the total power in the reflected signal. And that total power is controlled by the reflection coefficient of the surface. So this is the reflection coefficient we all study as undergraduates. If you have an interface between two media and there is a plane wave incident, the reflected wave has a reflection power reflection coefficient that's controlled by the incidence angle and the dielectric properties of the surface. So on the left, then, there is the standard plot of this reflection coefficient as a function of the incidence angle, phi zero. It's called theta here because the diagrams are taken from different references. I should have fixed that. But the horizontal axis is the angle phi zero in the diagram on the right. And you can see blue curve and a red curve. Each one of them is a different reflection coefficient that depends on the polarization of the incident wave. So if the electric field is in the plane orthogonal to the plane of the page you have, you get different answer from the electric field being in that plane. So this is what's called the TE for transverse electric, where the electric field is normal to the page, and transverse magnetic, where the electric field is in the plane of the page. The spacecraft transmits a circularly polarized radio signal. So it has both TE and TM in the incident wave. But when it hits the surface, it's affected. These two components are affected by very different dielectric, by very different reflection coefficient. So at an angle phi zero, which is close to the angle where one of them dies, the TM component completely goes to zero. The reflected signal is essentially TE only, and the TE is a linear polarization which has equal amounts of power in the right circular and left circular. So at this particular angle, that is to say the vertical dashed line here with where one of the reflection coefficients go to zero, the reflected signal will always have equal power in the right circular and left circular, even though the incident signal is only right circular. And in general, at angles away from that, there will be both right circular and left circular, but in varying amounts depending on how far one is from this angle. That angle is the Brewster angle, the angle at which the one of the reflection coefficient goes to zero, and it depends strongly on the dielectric constant of the surface. So by doing experiments in the neighborhood of the Brewster angle and measuring the power in the RCP, right circularly polarized, and LCP, the R and L components, the right and left components of the reflected echo, and ratioing these, you get a very good indication of what the dielectric constant is. And that's the last curve at the bottom here, which shows at a given dielectric constant, which for which these curves are, here is three, just a number, going again as a function of angle, measuring the relative power in one of the two. Here is the opposite circular, so if the incident is right circular, this is the left circular power over the sum of the two as a function of the incidence angle. You see that the ratio changes considerably as a function of incidence angle, at the Brewster angle exactly it's 1. It's half because we're summing the two, we're normalizing by the sum of the two. But half here means that the two components, the two reflected components, have about the same power. And it favors one or the other if you move away from the Brewster angle. If you change the directed constant, you change the Brewster angle. So one important measurement then that gives direct information about the dielectric constant is measuring the power in both polarized components and ratioing them. And that will be the key for the couple of results that you'll see in a second. It's a little bit of a complicated concept, but it's really nothing but the fact that the incident wave is RCP and the reflected echo in general will have both RCP and LCP in a mixture of amounts that depends on the dielectric constant in a very straightforward way. And the straightforward way is the curve at the bottom left you see there. So by measuring the power in each component and ratioing that power, you get an indication for what the dielectric constant is. And because it's a ratio measurement, you don't really need to know the absolute value of each one very accurately. Uncertainties added to each one of them are removed in that ratio, and the ratio itself becomes a very good indicator of what the dielectric constant is. And the next slide will show that the experiments we've done span an incidence angle range that covered the Brewster range. So the Brewster range for the kind of materials we expected on the surface of Titan are 50 to 70 degrees or so. And T14, the two red arrows point to the T14 change the angles as a function of time for the T14 inbound and the T14 outbound, and both of them were smack into the Brewster angle range. T27, as I said, the data I'm presenting today come from T14 and T27. So T27 is where the green arrow points, and that's outside the Brewster range, or at least close to its outer boundary and outside that. So you'd expect the echo to favor one polarization and would be weak at the other polarization. And yet we will see that we have also detected the weak polarization for T27 inbound. And that's really very good, because you need to detect both polarizations to get to the dielectric constant of the surface. So moving on to slide 12, this is the T27. This is the experiment we did on March 25 this year, the T27 inbound. This is where we looked at the south pole of Titan, south polar region of Titan. And I'm just showing you what we monitor in the operation room during that experiment. We look at the spectrum of the signal. So we're trying to see whether there is an echo or not in the spectrum of the signal by looking at all three frequencies and looking at two polarizations. Here I'm showing only one polarization, but all three frequencies. And if all works well, if the receivers are tuned properly, and if there is an echo, it should show in the center of the band. And as you can see here, the X band shows a very nice, strong echo right at the center of the band, and the S band shows also a very reasonably strong echo at the center of the band, but not the K band. The one on the right is the K band, doesn't show any echo at all. And I'll try to explain why is that as we go along. But the thing we monitor in real time are spectra like this as a function of time, with usually with our hands on our hearts looking at the center of the spectrum, trying to see whether there are bumps above the noise baseline or not. But then, of course, we take the data home and we look for very weak echoes in a much more careful way. But it's always nice when you can see it ahead of time in real time, and these are the detection of the echo from the surface of Titan, very clear echo from the surface of Titan from the south polar region. The next slide shows the actual spectra that's computed after the fact, and so the slide 13 shows the spectra stacked in time. So if you this is a three-dimensional plot with frequency running from left to right at the bottom, and then the spectra that are measured as a function of time stacked one after the other to form what's called a spectrogram, or a plot of spectra as a function of time. And you can see that over most of the time we looked at the south polar region, which here is about 43 to about 65, it's about 22 minutes of observation for T27 inbound. Over 19 of these, we see very strong echo, and that was not the case in T14. In T14, as you'll see in a second, we've seen the echo only to be over a very localized region of the surface and only for a very short period of time, to about 3 or 4 minutes on one side and about 7-8 minutes on the other side. So there are very strong echoes from the south polar region of Titan, as you can see here. We usually don't show the spectra in this format, three-dimensional plot. We use frequency and time as the axis of an image, and then the strength of the echo, which is the third dimension here, we represent using color. So the next slide shows such kind of a representation. So the vertical axis is frequency, the horizontal axis is time, and the color, which is the color axis you see on the right, represents the strength of the echo. So red would be very strong here, and blue would be the noise. And as you can see, the noise floor is now the blue background you see in the image, and the strong echo that comes all the time for at least the 22 minutes of the observation is the colored line that's in the center of the plot. You can see that here the bandwidth of that we use to record the data is 16 kilohertz. So we've centered the echo, or we tuned the receiver so that if there is an echo, it would show at the center, which is 8 kilohertz. And indeed, you see the bright line and the center here is at about 8 kilohertz, and it stays all the time. The top picture is for the X band and RCP. So this is the same polarization as the incident signal. And then the left one, the right one, is for the LCP component. So here you see, even though this experiment is outside of the Brewster angle range, we still detect the LCP component, and it's just it's a lot weaker than the RCP component, but it's there. You can see the line at the center of the plot, and this is one of the first experiments where we also detected S-band, which are the bottom two plots, at both polarizations. So as you can see, there is a line in the middle in both cases on both the RCP and the LCP. So this is a beautiful bistatic data set that will tell us something about the dielectric constant of the south polar region. It's a problem we continue to work on. I'm not going to report some results on that today, but last year we did a similar experiment on T14 where the echo was much weaker. So the next slide, 15, shows the echo from T14 where, again, the LCP and RCP sequence of spectra are shown. And again, at the center of the band, which we tuned to show the echo if it's present to be at the center of the band, at the number 8, which is 8 kilohertz in frequency, you see that the signal climbs above the noise. And that is a very weak echo from the surface of Titan. As you can see, the strength here is no more than, if the noise floor is 1, like in all these diagrams, it's no more than 10% of the noise floor, but so it's a weak echo, but it's real. It's very clear that it is very different from the rest of the noise floor around it, and we can use, again, spectrograms to show that echo. So the next slide, number 16, shows the spectrogram now in terms of an image. Again, frequency is on the vertical axis, and time is on the horizontal axis, and the color is the color of a pixel at a given time, and frequency is the strength of the echo. You see that if you look at again at the center of the band, most of the time we don't see anything. And then near the very end of the experiment, the last few minutes of the experiment, the color changes to red, indicating the weak echo I just showed you. It shows both in the RCP component, which is the left top, and the LCP component, which is the right top. on the in, so this is the inbound side. So this is, these are the last few minutes of the inbound observation. And then the outbound is at the bottom. So this is still X-band, but now coming out from the occultation and doing the bistatic on the outbound side. And again, there is no echo most of the time. And then the echo shows for about 7 or 8 minutes in both the RCP and the LCP. And the next slide shows interpretation for this by summing up the power in the echo, both the RCP and LCP, and ratioing the sum so that you get the a measurement of the ratio for the observation angle for which T14 ingress and egress was conducted. So the axis here are the vertical axis is the ratio of the power in the two polarizations, and the horizontal axis is the angle C0, or the called the bistatic angle or the incidence angle, and the two red squares show the measured values for these incidence angle corresponding to the observation geometry. And then we compare that to expected theoretical behavior for different dielectric constants of assumed surfaces. So for epsilon equals 1.5, we have a curve. For epsilon 2, we have a curve, 3, 4.5, and 6. And again, the measurements indicate a dielectric constant of about 1.6, and very different from the as you can see, it's well separated from the curves for 2, 3, and etc. Dielectric constants of 1.6 are usually attributed to liquid hydrocarbons. So we may have seen a liquid hydrocarbon on the surface at these locations, but one has to be careful to say also that you can synthesize dielectric constants in many different ways. So let me show you the last slide on the subject, which shows that if you have a medium of dielectric constant 1.6 that you measure, that could be liquid hydrocarbons, that the brown block that we've seen, but it can be also inhomogeneous. It can be due to taking a medium of higher dielectric constant and then reducing the dielectric constant artificially by either introducing voids in the surface, in the volume. So this would be like a porous medium, like the picture you see at the bottom right. Or it could be a solid ice surface that is covered by a fluffy material in the form of a snow particles, where the wave then, when it's incident on the surface, is seeing mostly the uncompacted snow particles at the top of the H2 ice. Within the domain of the solution, there is also the liquid hydrocarbons in here. So we still have to look at what we got from the other experiments and how they compare. The nature of the surface appears to be very different depending on where the location, where the place you look is. So we need to look at this also collectively as we complete the analysis for the other cases. But definitely the T14 data suggests that we may have looked at liquid hydrocarbon kind of regions. And as I said, it's not a definitive kind of an answer because we only measure an effective dielectric constant. And as I just mentioned, you can synthesize media to have this effective dielectric constant in different ways. So
quick question.
Yeah.
This is Trina. Hi.
Hi.
I mean, liquid hydrocarbons, that's a really sort of exciting result. And as you say, you could be fooled. Is there some observation that some other instrument can provide, like maybe a radar observation that would really, you know, in your mind, sort of nail it down one way or the other?
I think the opposite may be true, which is where you think radar sees liquid hydrocarbon, that is to say they see little reflection from the surface, because what they really see is just the fact that the surface is relatively flat, and therefore it does not reflect much energy to their instrument. So they say that is a liquid hydrocarbon, but not only based on that, based on some other inferences that relate to shorelines and things like that. But if there was an opportunity for us to do a bistatic over one of those regions, to be able to measure the dielectric constant, or if we look in the nominal mission or an extended mission and see tracks that we overlap over regions where they think they have seen liquid hydrocarbons, then we can check definitely whether the dielectric constant we compute agrees with that or not.
Okay, thanks.
But we, unfortunately, what we do measure is a dielectric constant. So if you can synthesize an artificial medium with this dielectric constant, then that's a likelihood also. It's just how if you look at flat regions that others also think that they are liquid hydrocarbons, then that's more of a supportive kind of an answer.
So. And then one more question, I might have missed it, but so the slide 17 results are from T14,
right.
And what about the T27?
I did not finish the analysis for that yet.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So
that'll be interesting to see if
it has very promising results too. Yeah. That there the echo. I mean, the South Pole has a much more flat kind of a nature. The near equatorial regions are much more rough because, as you can see, the spectra we see, the spectrograms I just showed, didn't show echo most of the time.
Right.
And that means that the reflected echo is not quasi-specular. And so it's spread in frequency over a very broad range, and it's very weak over any part of this range, so it's hidden in the noise. And in that case, we don't see an echo. And only when the surface gets to be more flat, that all the energy are concentrated in a very narrow band, and we see it very clearly standing above the spectrum, above the noise floor. So we see it in the spectrum. So T27 shows, if you look carefully at the spectra I showed, they hardly show any spread in frequency. So they look very much like they came from a very, very flat surface. So the nature of the South Polar region is definitely very different from that near the equatorial region. Although, as I said, if we have a liquid hydrocarbon, here it's a lot more confined in T14 case, it's a lot more confined in terms of the spatial extent, and we only see it over a very short period of the experiment. In the South Polar region, we're basically looking all the time at a flat surface region. But whether that's liquid hydrocarbon or not, that's not really very obvious at all at this time. But it will be interesting because the data there is much, the signal-to-noise ratio for the measurements are much better. Okay, so moving on to the Titan occultations. I'm moving very slowly, unfortunately, but I'll try to speed up the rest of it a little bit. So the Titan occultations, much like the bistatic, we completed 4 Titan occultations during the nominal mission. All of them completed, 2 of them last year and 2 of them this year. So again, I'll select just one example of a Titan occultation and discuss it in a little bit more detail. But there is ongoing work on all 4 of them to try to characterize the results collectively. So the first one, the slide 19 here shows one of the. This is actually the last one, T31, conducted on May 27 this year, which was a south coming. The spacecraft comes from the South Pole to the North Pole, so to speak. The latitudes covered are indicated on the right. They are 74.6 degrees. Negative 75.4. That's the ingress. That's the south latitude, and 74.6 degrees on the north. The 4 of them are collectively shown on the next slide. So the first 2, T12 and T14, were east-west kind of occultations. The ingress is on the east side. The egress is on the west side. And the last 2, the T27 and T31, are north or south-north occultations. And the one I'll talk about mostly today is T12, which is the first one. But as I said, there is good progress being made analyzing all these 4 together, and there is a paper in preparation on that issue. But since the results are not completed yet, they weren't included here. The next slide, 21, shows roughly the basic concept involved. I don't want to spend too much time on it because it's a little bit of a detailed kind of a slide. But the point it tries to make is that a signal, as it goes through a gaseous atmosphere, which is represented schematically here by the red line, going through the atmosphere, that's a radio ray from the Earth to the spacecraft. The spacecraft actually transmits the signal, and the Earth receives the signal, so it's the opposite of what I showed here. But the concept is the same. There is reciprocity here, and the concept is the same. So the signal goes through the atmosphere and picks up phase due to the path through the atmosphere. So when it exits from the atmosphere, the blue line on the right is the wavefront, and on the wavefront there are phase perturbations called phi sub r. And these phase perturbations carry information about the density of the atmosphere along the path. If the atmosphere is more dense, then the phase is larger, etc. And then the wavefront propagates to the spacecraft and suffers from diffraction as it does that. But if we forget that for a second, then the phase fluctuations on the blue line on the wavefront exiting from the atmosphere is what the spacecraft roughly measures. It's really measured after being diffracted. One would like to recover the properties of the atmosphere from the measured phase perturbations. And that's the equation at the bottom, where the phase perturbations are related to the so-called refractivity of the medium, N, capital N, and the refractivity relates to the number density. So one would like to recover from the measured phase the refractivity as a function of radius. So one must invert this equation to recover capital N from measured phi. We don't really measure phi directly. We measure the rate of change of phi any time the phase changes as a function of position or as a function, since the spacecraft is flying parallel to this blue line, radius or time are related. So rate of change of phase is Doppler shift. And therefore, what the spacecraft really measures is the Doppler shift. And we invert the Doppler shift directly. We don't invert the phase. But if you think conceptually, you are recovering from the measurements the refractivity as a function of radius. And then, assuming hydrostatic equilibrium and knowing the number density, you can recover the pressure. And then, assuming the equation of state and knowing the pressure and the number density, you can recover the temperature, given that you know the composition also. So occultations don't measure compositions very well. We have to rely on other people's measurements of the composition. But for Titan, it's a very simple assumption. We just use nitrogen or nitrogen with a small percentage of CH4 of methane. So the composition uncertainty here is not as high as in other cases. But essentially what a spacecraft occultation provides here, it provides temperature as a function of height, pressure as a function of height, number density as a function of height, as well as the structure of the atmosphere, like you will see in a second from other perturbations in the signal. But to do this properly, you have to account for all what I listed on the left in here, including the fact that the rays I just schematically showed at the top are really bent in the atmosphere, so there is changes in the signal properties due to this bending. The atmospheres are not spherically symmetric. They usually have asymmetry in them. There is wind in the atmosphere. There is absorption along the path and maybe also scattering along the path. So you have to account for everything, but the concept is you measure phase perturbations or frequency perturbations due to the atmosphere, and then try to recover the properties of the atmosphere from the measurements. The next slide shows the case for T12. And the measurement here is of the frequency residual. So the sinusoid that goes through the atmosphere has a frequency and phase and amplitude. All these will be perturbed when the signal goes through the atmosphere. And here I'm showing the measured perturbations in terms of frequency as a function of time. And again, the frequency here is not the full frequency. It's just the part due to the atmosphere. So we've taken out the part due to propagation in free space. And what's left is what perturbations the atmosphere introduced on the frequency. In free space, of course, there are no perturbations, and you see the residual starting as the spacecraft approaches Titan, so this is the ingress, and you see that the frequency residual is zero, but once the signal starts probing the atmosphere, the frequency turns and changes very quickly because of the refraction in the atmosphere. And one thing you'll notice right away, which is unfortunately because the scale here is not very good, something got clobbered into the conversion to PDF. The vertical axis numbers are gone, but the two numbers that are important are preserved still, which is that in free space there is zero Doppler. By the end of the experiment, the Doppler is of the order of 4 kilohertz. So here also we have to tune the receiver to keep the signal into the bandwidth, much like in the bistatic case. But the important thing is look over what time scale the atmosphere effects are happening. The horizontal axis, the tick marks are separated by 50 seconds. So it took a minute to a minute and a half for the signal to go from the top of the atmosphere all the way till the surface of Titan when we lost the signal here. Experiments, Titan occultations are extremely fast, nothing like we've ever done before in any occultations of bodies of the solar system. And therefore, the maneuver that has to be executed, as I said, is a very demanding one. And fortunately, that all of them worked, so that's just a testimony to the kind of competency that people that design these maneuvers, which is the sequencing team of the radio science group, it's a testimony to their their competence, really, because the experiment is extremely fast and very sensitive to pointing. If you have a trajectory error, if you have a pointing error, you would lose the signal immediately. Yet, as you can see here, the Doppler is being tracked all the way till we've reached the surface. I know we reached the surface because of the other slide, which I'll show you in a second. But that's the kind of information one needs then to recover the temperature profile, which is shown on the right, through this orbital inversion process, which I described schematically in the previous slide. So what you see here is the first temperature profile that was measured after this was only the second occultation after the Voyager occultation. Voyager did one occultation of Titan. This was the second one. I'll compare with the Voyager answer in a second. But the real important number that important part here is that the measurements are from an altitude of about 200 kilometers, where we start being sensitive to the atmosphere all the way till the surface, and therefore it's a characterization of the thermal profile in the atmosphere with a very high spatial resolution, because the diffraction effects limit our resolution to a Fresnel scale, and the Fresnel scale here is of the order of a kilometer. So it's one of the few experiments that capture the thermal structure of Titan atmosphere with very high spatial resolution, but only over the bottom 200 kilometers. We're not sensitive very much above that. And clearly the stratosphere and the troposphere here the structure is very different over these two main regions of the atmosphere. The temperature near the surface is still very close to what Voyager measured, which is about 94 degrees Kelvin. And the pressure is about 1.5 bar, just like in the Voyager case. The next slide compares the measurements from Voyager with the measurements from Cassini. So the different colors here, black and red, are the T12 experiment on the inbound and outbound sides, ingress and egress. So you see that in the stratosphere there are differences. Some of that difference, these differences can be deceptive sometimes because of errors in the trajectory affect the answer most prominently at the very highest altitudes. But as you go down in the troposphere, the curves are essentially identical. So there are four curves on top of one another, and in the troposphere, they are almost identical. The fourth one is the Huygens probe in situ measurements of the atmosphere, which agrees very well with both the Voyager observations as well as the Cassini observations. And I'm always struck by the fact that the temperature in the stratosphere is so stable. It indicates that the troposphere is so much identical. It indicates a very stable atmosphere in these near equatorial regions. We continue to see very similar behavior in the other occultations, but there are small differences. So the occultations show some differences between these profiles, and of course the differences get to be larger in the stratospheres, and some of them actually show very unusual kind of behavior. But that's all still to be worked out in detail, and I'm not going to talk about it anymore here. I just want to show here that at least from one observation, the atmosphere of Titan, at least in the lower part of it, appears to be very stable. There were 25 years between Voyager and Cassini, but yet the temperature structure appears to be extremely the same, extremely well preserved. The ionosphere also is another target of the observations, and this is the slide number 24 shows what we get from the frequency residuals. In that case, the frequency residuals are caused by phase changes, but the phase changes are not due to the neutral atmosphere, but they are due to the plasma in the ionosphere, and therefore the outcome is the number density, the electron number density in the atmosphere. So what the slide is showing here is the electron number density on the vertical axis, on the horizontal axis, and altitude on the vertical axis. And there are multiple curves shown here. One is the yellow curve is a theory, but the measurements are the Voyager and the T12, Ingres and Egress. So the Voyager, which is the blue curve, appears to show higher electron number density at the latitude probe, Voyager probe near equatorial latitudes. T12 was slightly south, was about 30 degrees south on the ingress and about 50 degrees south on the egress. So the green and the red show a peak at about the same location, about 1,200 kilometer altitude, but with slightly different values or somewhat different values. And the different values are because one measurement is on the dusk terminator, where the plasma has been in sun, where the atmosphere has been in sunlight for a long time, so the electron number density are somewhat higher, and the red curve is on the dawn side, where the plasma was a lot less in sunlight, and therefore the peak number density is smaller. We have collected eight of these because of four occultations, ingress and egress, and they offer a very variable kind of a picture for Titan atmosphere. Things are not the same at similar latitudes, so there is again a story still to be told about variability in the ionospheric structure as a function of latitude from this rich set of eight observations. So this is the end of my Titan part. Oh no, I'm sorry. There is a little bit of information about Titan also comes from the fact that the sinusoid changes not only in frequency but also in strength. And the strength in change in strength comes from two sources. One is the fact that the rays in the atmosphere bend in the atmosphere, so the energy drops because of ray tubes diverging. So this is called refractive defocusing, and that's just a geometric effect that one can take out from knowledge of the fact of the how rays refract as a function of altitude. But the other one is a real change in intensity due to absorption of the signals in the atmosphere. So this is real absorption of signal in the atmosphere. So again, if you look at the top panel, this is the ingress coming from free space. The intensity of the signal is almost unchanged, but as the ray hits the atmosphere, the intensity starts dropping down, and in doing so, there is a large scale kind of a drop down, but also there are small scale fluctuations as it does so. The small scale fluctuations are signatures of turbulence in the atmosphere as well as gravity waves, and the large scale structure is a signature of a true absorption in the atmosphere. And then by the time you get to the surface, the signal drops all of a sudden, as you can see here, and then hits the noise baseline. The red curve and the blue curve are two separate stations on the ground observing at the same time. So you can see here that even though one station is in California and the other station is in Madrid, they were observing almost identically the same signal. So all this structure is real. This is not noise. This is not an artifact of observations at the station, artifact of the observing system at the stations. These are all real Titan signatures. If you look at the wiggles in both the red and blue lines, they are almost identical, except when you get into the noise, and there the noise is totally independent. And then on the egress side, again, coming, that's the bottom curve, that's about 50 degrees south. You see again the signal climbing suddenly from behind the limb of Titan. It's not really sudden because of the fraction effect. So there is a finite tapering, but that's just the effect of limb diffraction. And then again, the climbing in strength and the wiggles are signature of gravity waves and turbulence. And then going back into free space and the signal being constant after you get out of the atmosphere. The next view graph, or the next slide, 26, shows the previous one was just X band. It shows after you take the trajectory into effect and translate time to height in the atmosphere, and after you remove the effect of refractive defocusing, the fact that ray tubes diverge, what's left is the real absorption. So it's showing the extinction in the signal, the strength of the signal on the horizontal axis, but in a log scale, in decimal. And the vertical axis is height. So instead of time now, that's height above the 2575 reference radius. And you can see that there are three curves. There are two panels, one for ingress, one for egress. And there are three curves, one for each of the frequencies we use. And the three frequencies are affected very differently. As you can see, the red curve is the longest wavelength S-band, the green is X-band, and the blue is K-band. So you can see that the K-band, the shortest wavelength, is being extinguished much, much more quickly than the other two. In fact, it's completely lost at about 10 kilometers above the surface, while the other two, again, X-band is extinguished more than S-band, but both of them reach the surface. The surface is the zero kind of a level. Again, the zero means 2575, so the left one extinguishes at about this radius, but the right one keeps going for slightly more, for a kilometer or so below this. Again, the fraction here is very important, so we have to take the fraction out before finding what the radius of the surface really is at these locations. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the three frequencies are affected very, very differently. And that is a new measurement. Cassini is a spacecraft, the first spacecraft to characterize the extinction in the atmosphere of Titan, the microwave absorption in the atmosphere of Titan in this level of detail. Voyager had only X and S band and did not have the stability to profile the extinction to this kind of a level. So there are no extinction profiles from Voyager. There is only upper bounds on the extinction. Here we have a detailed profile at both ingress and egress at eight different latitudes. So that's a quantum leap over what Voyager has already provided in terms of extinction characterization. If you think in terms of parallel analogs for Earth kind of observations, Ka-band is being used a lot for satellite communications, and one enemy of Ka-band for satellite communications on Earth is rain in the atmosphere. So when we've seen this large extinction in the atmosphere, the first thought that came in mind is that we may be seeing rain in Titan's atmosphere, in the troposphere of Titan. So we've done an enormous kind of hours of work to try to characterize how much rain and what kind of particle sizes would be responsible. This is, I'm talking about methane and ethane rain, potential conjecture, methane and ethane rain in the troposphere of Titan. So we've done some modeling of what extinction we would expect to observe for models in the atmosphere of Titan that include rain. So the next slide, 27, shows at least the in a casual way, that's not the detailed way, but just a picture to show that if you do assume rain to be responsible, then you have, so what's shown here again on the vertical axis is the ratio of the K-band to X-band extinction you would expect for a particle for rain that has the droplet size that's shown on the horizontal axis. And we see a ratio of about 10, and that's a horizontal dashed line. So for particles of different refractive index, so if these were liquid methane, they would be about 1.7 real dielectric constant, but the imaginary part would be uncertain. And so the individual colored curves are for different imaginary parts. But you can see that there is two ranges of solutions right away. One is for particle sizes that are less than a millimeter, which are pointed to by the red arrow to the left. And then there are also droplets that are of size that reaches 1 centimeter that are highly insensitive to the imaginary part of the dielectric constant. So rain composed of particles of these size ranges could explain what we see. But when we calculate the number density so that we get the extinction we see, we get a large optical depth from the small particles. We get small optical depth from the large particles, but we don't get the X-band. We don't get the S-band absorption we see. So both of them have contradictions. And now we believe that what we are really seeing is what's in the slide 28, which is the extinction is caused by gaseous absorption rather than particulate absorption. They are due to the nitrogen collision-induced absorption, or sometimes also nitrogen CH4 collision-induced absorption. So the story is evolving, and just like what you do in science all the time, you try to find the best reason for what can explain what you observe, but and also the most self-consistent reason. If the based on the radio measurements only, you can say it's rain, but you would need so much of it that it would block the, it would essentially, the optical depth would be large enough for the ORS instruments to see the surface, which we know not to be true. So the most likely reason really is the gaseous absorption, and that is the result shown in 28. So time is running short, and I need to finish the rings quickly, but the rings are the most interesting kind of data to me, so I'm going to try to run through it quickly as I can. And we do similar kind of observations of the rings. These are occultation observations also. So slide 29 is one of the latest occultations we did this year also on REF 44. We did two ring occultations this year on REF 44 and 46. Those were in May and in June of this year. And the picture you see on 29, on slide 29, is the path of the spacecraft, again as the blue line, as seen from Earth, coming from the right to the left and passing behind the north, very high northern latitude of the Saturn atmosphere on the inside, coming near equatorial on the egress side, and then passing behind the ring. So this is an egress-only ring occultation, And it was really the first one-sided occultation we do in the tour. And on most other ring occultations, we see both the inside and the outside. Those were the diametric occultations at the beginning of the tour. But from now on, they are almost all one-sided, like this one here. And again, the rings were only 15 degrees open at this time. So the next slide shows what I mean by only 15 degrees ring opening. So the again, in occultations, the spacecraft will pass the downlink signal through the rings. For an observer on Earth, you see the rings much like the Hubble Space Telescope here sees the rings over time. When the rings are fully open, it's the picture on the very top right, and then the rings close systematically as a function of time. And this picture happens almost exactly during the 4 years nominal mission of Cassini. So as a function of time, the rings are closing down, and the first set of occultations we did were when the rings were nearly fully open, and then the occultation on Rev 44 and 46 are happening essentially near the middle of this diagram, and then near the end of the mission we do another set of occultations when the rings are closing. So the path length of the signal through the rings changes as a function of time, and that means when we look at opaque parts of the rings, they become more and more noise limited as time goes on. On the other hand, when we look at tenuous parts of the rings, they become more and more detectable as time goes on. So these geometries complement one another, but it was important to do the early occultations so that we are not noise limited over ring B, which is really a major ring that was not probed by Voyager, because the Voyager occultation happened when the rings were almost closed, 6 degrees open, so it's like the bottom picture you see in this diagram. So the Rev 44 and 46 are beginning to add information about how things change as the rings become more closed, and that will complement the information we get from the last set of occultations and also the ones in the extended mission where the rings are almost fully closed, and therefore we're extremely sensitive to tenuous structure but will be completely blocked by dense structure. So next slide, which again got unfortunately messed up in the PDF conversion, shows that ring opening angle on the vertical axis as a function of time. And that's so the wiggles here are the rings are closing as a function of time. The ring opening angle is going from 25 down to zero. And the wiggles are just because Earth moves around the sun, and therefore every year the geometry changes, and these wiggles are roughly a year apart. So this is just an artifact of the Earth's motion. And the circles, red circles, represent the actual occultations we do. So Rev 7 to 13 are the ones that were done when the rings were nearly fully opened. Not fully exactly, but fully 26 or so. These were from 23.5 to 20, or 19.5. And the end of the mission, from Rev 53 to 67, we do the closed ring occultations, or nearly closed ring occultations. The rest of the extended mission occultations follow 67, and therefore they are at a much smaller ring opening angle, reaching zero actually. We do one at 2 degrees. But bridging these two are the set of three occultations I show here on Rev 28, 44, and 46. Capturing this range of variation allows us to study how the signal is extinguished and scattered as a function of ring opening angle, and therefore tells us about the physical structure of the rings, in particular the vertical structure of the rings. But what I'll concentrate on here today is how radio science profiles ring structure and does that with exceptionally high resolution, and as it does that with multiple occultations, it essentially provides a very detailed characterization of how ring structure varies from location to location in a quantitative way. So that would be the emphasis. The topic I'll leave out for a future talk, it's not included in the slides, is extending that knowledge to the particle size level and talking about the physical properties of the particles, their sizes, how they clump together, how they distributed vertically in the ring plane, etc. That would take another talk by itself, and therefore that's left out. So the talk here is primarily showing you how we map ring structure with exceptionally high resolution and examples of what we've seen. So we map ring structure by observing how the signal is extinguished. So slide 32 shows again in a cartoonish way the difference between an imaging observation and a radio occultation or a stellar occultation for that matter. While an image shows the rings as a whole in either reflected or transmitted light, and therefore what you see really depends on not only on the optical depth of the rings, but also on what they are made of and the details of the grains, the surface, the details of the particle surfaces as they reflect light. In an occultation, the radio signal penetrates the ring. So it's, if you look at the red line at the top with incident intensity I0, it goes through the rings and it comes out as the equation at the bottom here, I0 e to the minus optical depth over sine the ring opening angle. The extinction in the radio signal gives you immediate characterization of the ring structure. But it does that, and it's a quantitative characterization insensitive to the details of the particles themselves. For example, the albedo of the particles, that's not immediately coupled in here except in the optical depth value itself. So by characterizing optical depth as a function of location, you characterize ring structure in a quantitative way. And in the case of radio occultations, you do that at three frequencies or three wavelengths. And each one of them sees the rings with a different eye. That's because the optical depth is a function of particle size. And therefore, as particle size relative to their wavelength. And therefore, for one wavelength, like in this case, the red curve, so what you see at the bottom is the optical depth profile over the range of the image from the Cassini, inner part of the Cassini division to all the way to the edge of the outer ring A, depicted at the bottom here as extinction of the signal as a function of ring radius. So this is the curve that you should try to simulate, because it all the other curves look like it. So zero here means the signal is in free space. It hasn't been extinguished at all. And then as you add optical depth, I0 drops to I0 e to the minus tau over sine b. So what we're plotting here is the drop in the signal strength. So as we drop more, there is more material. And we characterize the drop in terms of the optical depth. So the optical depth is plotted increasing downward versus ring radius. And any time we go back to zero, we're going back to free space. And any time we dip very far away from zero, that means more and more material encountered along the range. So the Cassini division, as you can see, the signal stays very close to free space, but in the body of the A-ring, there is a much bigger drop. Then we come back to free space near the edge of the ring in the Inky gap, and then in the Keeler gap before we hit the outside of the ring. And the fact that there are three colored curves here are because we're doing three wavelengths, and the fact that they are separating from one another as you move outward, meaning that they are experiencing different optical depths along the path. Because the optical depth for the red curve S-band is smaller than for the other two, that means there is material that S-band does not see while the other two frequencies see. And that immediately says there are particles that are of size less than the wavelength, the S-band wavelength. So there are particles less than 13 centimeters in size, not seen by the S-band, but seen by the other two. And near the very edge of the rings, you see the green and the blue curve also separate from one another. Again, the green is the S band, is the X band, the 3.6 centimeters, and the blue is the K band, the 0.94 centimeters. And again, the fact that the green is less than the blue says that the green is not seeing particles that the blue are seeing, and those are particles of size much less than 3.6 centimeters, millimeter-sized particles. So the three wavelengths allows you to relate structure also to the small sizes in the small particle sizes in the ring. For example, in the Cassini division, you also see the three frequencies separate, especially in the outer part of the Cassini division where there is a structure here where the optical depth linearly falls. It's called the ramp, and you can see the three wavelengths separating very clearly, indicating centimeter, millimeter, as well as decimeter. All three wavelengths see decimeter-sized particles, but S-bands start losing vision of particles that are less than its wavelength. Similarly, X-band, so the three wavelengths measure three different kind of structures where the structure and sizes are coupled together. So the next, all slides then will show optical depth increasing downwards versus radius, and there is a line at the top showing free space level. Usually there will be a line at the bottom also showing the noise level, but here the structure is the Cassini division, and we're well above the noise level, so there is no bottom line in here. So radio science occultations provide a radial structure, a map of the radial structure. We call it a profile of the radial structure of the rings, but at exceptionally high resolution that approaches few hundreds of meters, like you'll see in a second. But unfortunately, it doesn't come for free. We have to do very elaborate processing to do that. But this is just an example taken from a region of the rings where the signal level is not very highly extinguished. This is the Cassini division. And at the beginning of the Cassini division, there is the Huygens gap, where the signal level is close to the dashed line, the free space level. And I'm sorry to show you dirty laundry here. The free space level is not stable in this plot, but we compensate for pointing problems, and we have profiles that are much better than this one. It's just that is the one I could find at the time, so I used it. But the free space level is usually a lot more stable than what you see in here. And that gap has two ringlets in it. One is the gap is the Huygens gap, so these are the Huygens ringlets. One is it's called the main ringlet, and then one near the edge is called the outer ringlet. So I'll just use these as my example to show you how we get to profile the structure with very high resolution. But gaps in themselves are very interesting because gaps in Saturn's rings are envisioned to be opened by bodies embedded in the gaps. So one usually envisions a satellite in each one of these gaps, and the torque that the satellite exerts on neighboring particles would be responsible for opening the gap. But like I'll describe, we only know of two satellites embedded in the rings, yet we have so many gaps. Here I show you eight of them in the Cassini division that are yet to be explained. And this may or may not contain satellites. Of course, everybody is looking very hard to see whether they can see the direct or indirect signature of satellites, including radio science. But so far, all the gaps in the rings are not clearly associated with satellites, except for the Encke gap and the Keeler gap. And both of them are in the A ring, in the outer part of the A ring. So next slide shows the Huygens gap main ringlet, and it shows it as blue curves on the left and red curves on the right. The blue curves show what the spacecraft actually measured when it went behind that ringlet. It shows the strength of the signal on the top. It's characterized in terms of optical depth. Again, zero means free space, so this is the gap. And the ringlet itself is the dip in that you see in the middle. And radio science measures not only the strength of the sinusoid, but also the frequency and phase. So the phase is plotted at the bottom in here. And you can see that associated, when you're in free space, there is a very small change in the phase. But when we went behind the ringlet, there is a large change in the phase. And you see the regular oscillations near the edge as they go transition from the edge of the ringlet to free space both on the on both sides of the ringlet and also in the phase information. Yet, this is what we measure, but what we measure is diffraction limited. So if we remove this, if we somehow find a way to reverse diffraction effect, then we would see how the rings actually look like. So this is a garbled image, and one has to do work to remove diffraction effect in order to see the exact profile of the ring. So radio science does not measure the ring structure directly. It measures a diffraction-limited version of it, and that's represented here by the blue curve. And what it does is it takes these measurements and does invert it using techniques I'll just discuss very briefly in a second to get to the true profiles. And the true profiles are the one on the right, showing now that the wiggles are all gone, and the edge of the embedded ringlet is extremely sharp, like you see in here, and most of the phase oscillations that were in the blue curve are gone also, and there are some phase fluctuations due to the ringlet itself. The red curves are what the rings exactly look like. The blue curve is what the spacecraft actually measures. And the process for going from one to one, from one to the other, is exactly like the process that one goes from a recorded hologram to a played hologram. A diffraction wavefront is a hologram. It preserves information about the strength and the phase of the signal, and you need to play the hologram to get to the true image. We do that on the computer through very significant kind of processing to get to the red curves you see on the right. But the red curves are, because we've taken diffraction out, the resolution, the spatial resolution, are a few hundred meters. The Fresnel scale of diffraction typically is few kilometers, 5 kilometers. So when we remove the fraction, we get the profiles with exceptionally high resolution, 400 meters, the ones I show today, and we're pushing towards 200 meters nowadays. So the concept behind that is shown in slide 35, where you can see a model of the rings, just a random distribution of particles where the wave coming from the left goes through, and the perturbations due to the rings are called T, X prime on the right of the model flap. But by the time the perturbations get to the spacecraft, the field on that wavefront reaches the spacecraft after individual parts of it interfere with one another. So the spacecraft sees the Fresnel diffraction pattern, much like we all study in optics, is that the field behind the slit is not the field you observe some distance from the slit. What one observes is either the Fresnel diffraction pattern or the Fraunhofer diffraction pattern. Here, it's in general, it's the Fresnel diffraction pattern. So what the spacecraft measures and what is desired, which is the profile of the rings, are different. And the equations at the bottom show how we go from one to the other through what's called the inverse Fresnel transform. So there is very elaborate processing to be able to reconstruct from what's measured the actual ring profile. The next slide shows the outer ringlets of the Huygens gap. Again, the blue is what is measured, and the right is what the real ring really look like. And there is a world of difference between the two. As I said, you cannot get a high resolution profile of the rings unless that is done, and that's what we have done for all the data we measured to be able to get to the high resolution profiles that is really our product from one of our main products for this from this kind of an observation. The point this slide makes is that it shows you also. If you look at the red curve at the bottom, the vertical axis is phase, and phase is the tick marks are 0.05 degrees apart. 0.05, pi is 180 degrees, so 0.05 out of pi, the tick marks are 9 degrees apart. So as you can see here, the measurements are, we need to measure phase, which is as small as 9 degrees, every time the wave propagates one wavelength, and at X band that's 3.6 centimeter wavelength, it suffers a phase of 360 degrees. So to measure a phase change of 9 degrees means you need to measure changes in the phase path that are a fraction of a wavelength. So even though the distance to Saturn is 1.5 billion kilometers, when the phase path changes by a millimeter, we need to be able to detect that. And that's why there is an ultra-stable oscillator on the spacecraft, is that you can measure such small phase. So this is one thing that most people don't really recognize about radio science. It's an exceptionally sensitive kind of an experiment to any phase changes along the path. This is how we get to do profiles of the rings at 100 meter resolution. This is how we measure very small effects in the atmosphere of Titan. It's by the fact that we have a USO on the spacecraft that allows us to measure very small phase changes. And now I will just go through examples of profiles of ring structure that we measured from some of our occultations we've completed. So in the next slide, 37, shows the cuts in the rings. I chose 10 out of 15 cuts we've completed so far. The first cuts cut both the inside and the outside. So the inside is on the left, the outside is on the right, and the four colored lines are the Rev 7, 8, 10, and 12, which were executed in 2005. And then Rev 46 and 44 are also shown. Those were executed this year. And so these are 10 cuts that I use as example. I use results from these cuts as examples in the slide to follow. And the thing that you have to keep in mind that we really have 15 cuts. So even though I'll show you six profiles at a time, it's just because I can't show 15 profiles at a time. But essentially, the occultations dissect the rings. The more occultations you have, the more dissections you have, and each dissection will show you the structure of the rings at very high resolution and the variability in this structure with longitude. So,
Tom?
Yes?
I hate to interrupt you because this is really great, but I'm worried that we're going to run out of time because I think that we're going to lose our phone line in about 10 or 12 minutes.
Okay, I will go for 5 more minutes and then stop. How's that?
Okay, well, however you want to do it, because, I mean, it's all really interesting stuff. There's a lot of great stuff here. So however, if you want to just go ahead or skip into your highlights or however you want to do it, I just wanted to...
Okay, I think I will make the point with the next slide, and then I'll stop and take questions. How is that? Because the rest of the story is a bit structured in a way that it fits into one another, and therefore it's not easy to jump from one piece to the other. So I will just make the point with the next slide, and then stop and take questions.
And what number slide will that be? They correspond to the numbers on these things?
38. So I just finished 37.
Okay. And you have a total of 59 slides in it?
I have 60.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. So why is it that one does multiple occultations? So I showed you on slide 37 that we have 15 cuts so far, So one would tend to think that as you do an occultation, you see the ring structure, so why do multiple occultations? So that's what the point made by my last slide, 38, which shows, again, the Huygens gap with the two. So these are six cuts out of the 15 I just spoke about. On seven, on the inbound side, on the left-hand side, there is seven on inbound, eight inbound, and 10 inbound. And on the right-hand side, there's seven egress, eight egress, and 10 egress. All of them here looking at the part of the rings which I just described, the Huygens gap, and including the two ringlets, the one in the middle, the broader one, and the one near the outer edge, the narrower one. And as you can see here, every experiment sees the Huygens gap differently. The edge of the Huygens gap, the inner edge, which is the outer edge of ring B, moves in and out, and it's from experiment to experiment, You don't see the edge at the same location. The ringlet itself changes look, position, and profile as you cut the rings, multiple cuts, and so is the outer one. You see different dynamical structure every time you do an occultation, and it's the collective analysis of these profiles that provide one with complete, with a more complete characterization of a given dynamical phenomenon. So this is not only the case for the Huygens gap and its ringlet, it's for the case of many dynamical structures in the ring. I was going to show you more examples of this, and also show you the example of ring B, which is a totally new ringlet, total new structure that we haven't observed before in any of ring C or ring B or ring A. But because of time limitations, I didn't realize it's going to take that long. I had hoped to move a lot more quickly, but my problem is I try to show you the concepts also behind these and not only the results. But
I think it's really great and helpful too.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a price to pay for everything. So I'll stop here and entertain a question or two if you have any before they take the line away from us.
Hello.
Do people have questions?
Yes,
please, go ahead. I'm ready.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Okay, this is Matthew. I have a question going back to the measurements done at Titan. When you're trying to measure these raindrops and you came up short with nothing, that does not totally discount methane rain, I would assume, because this was a short-term measurement, and I would imagine that there's actually a lot of active weather in that atmosphere.
Absolutely. If you go back, if you roll back to slide 28, if you have what we tried to do is explain the whole observation. We've seen an extinction throughout the troposphere, and we tried to account for the extinction by saying the whole thing is due to rain. But that just showed that we need too much rain to do it. But it doesn't discount the fact that we still have rain. We still can have absorption due to gaseous ammonia. So if you are looking at slide 28, you will see, so concentrate on the left slide and the blue line. You'll see a dashed blue line, and that's the model or the computation if we have gaseous absorption only. But you see the solid line, which is what we measure, shows deviations from that. And those deviations could still be very well due to rain. And so we have not discounted the fact that rain can exist. We cannot explain what we see fully as just rain. We would need too much of it. So there are two things happening at the same time. There may be rain, but a large part of what we see is due to gaseous absorption also. So rain is still a very much a likelihood in the troposphere of Titan.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Was there another question?
Yeah, there was, but it disappeared.
Okay, well, I think this is all really great stuff, Sam, and thank you so much for taking the time to put it all together. The rest of the, everybody has your presentation, so people can feel free to go through on their own with your examples and just the rest of the material in here.
My apology again. It's the tendency to try to explain reasons more than get into the results right away.
I think you don't want me to throw
the answers at you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for going into such detail on the behind the scenes stuff and all of the ideas behind it. We really appreciate it, and I'd like to thank everyone for participating. And remind you that our next Charm Telecom will be on October 30th, and the topic of that one will be the Iapetus flyby that we recently did and preliminary results from a few instruments from Iapetus.
Well, thank you for inviting me to talk.
Thank you very much for doing it, and thanks everyone for participating.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks.